guide. Now, we just started this Tuesday, and we were looking at the first message. Now, don't forget that there are four messages that Haggai is going to deliver. Just picture him as a preacher giving a series of four messages straight from headquarters, straight from the Lord. And here is message number one. Now, first, let's look at the time of the message. Now, we touched on this just in closing. It was the second year of Darius the king. You'll notice in verse 1, in the second year of Darius the king, it doesn't tell you which Darius it is. I indicated that there are two kings named Darius. There's Darius I, known as Hystaspes. He was king from 521 to 486. Then there was Darius II, known as Notus, and he was king from 424 to 395. Now, the question is, which one of these kings would be in view here? Well, there could be no question about which one. It would be Darius I, Hystaspes, the one who reigned from 521 to 486 B.C. Now, there are several reasons for this, and I want to give them to you, and then I want you to pick up on the one that Linka suggested at the close of the hour, which is very interesting in view of the facts that we have. But notice, first of all, that Zerubbabel, the governor of Judah, and Joshua, the high priest, were aligned. Now, that's important. They were aligned in the second year of Darius, because as you read, it says the second year of Darius the king, and both Zerubbabel, the governor of Judah, and Joshua, the high priest, were alive at that time. And that would have been absolutely impossible in the second year of Darius the second, known as Notus, since the second year of his reign was 113 years after Zerubbabel and Joshua had returned from captivity in Babylon to Jerusalem in 436 B.C. Now, if you turn to Ezra chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, it makes it very clear that Zerubbabel and Joshua and other leaders led the 49,897 Jews from captivity in Babylon back to the province of Judah, of which Jerusalem was the capital. He led them back, or they led them back. That was the year, was the first year of Cyrus. So that is dated for us. Now, all you've got to do is do a little arithmetic. You have to remember that you can't have a little boy leading almost 50,000 people from captivity in Babylon back to Judah. He is a leader. He's not a baby. He's a leader, and Joshua's not a baby. He's a leader. So you've got to allow time for these men to grow up. How old they were, we're not told. But they were old enough to be strong leaders. And to whatever age you allow for that, even if you say, well, they are in their 20s, well, then you've got to add 113 years to that. That would give you 133 years at least, and the people just didn't live that long at that point of time. Remember, Moses said the length of man's life is 70 years, and that by reason of strength, the Lord gives him a few more years. Well, just praise him for it in Psalm 90. But this would be way too long as far as the longevity of life is concerned. So that would rule out Darius II and necessitate that it be Darius I. Also, we're told in chapter 2, verse 3 of Haggai that there were some people in the time that this was written, the second year, or the time that these prophecies were given, the second year of Darius the king. There were some people there who had seen Solomon's temple before it was destroyed. Now, remember chapter 2, verse 3. Haggai said, who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory? other words, there are some people that are left among you that saw this house in our first glory, saw Solomon's temple before it was destroyed. And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it, that is Solomon's temple that you saw, as nothing? Now, this implies very clearly that these people were alive and saw Solomon's temple before it was destroyed. Now, remember, they have to be old enough to see Solomon's temple and know what it looks like. A little baby is not going to remember what Solomon's temple looks like. They have to be old enough to see Solomon's temple and remember what it looks like. Now, Solomon's temple was destroyed, according to some, 588, according to some others, 586. But if you take the 588 date, all you need to do is a little arithmetic. Now, the second year of Darius II would be 423 B.C. Now, what's the difference between 588 B.C. and 423 B.C.? You know how many years you have there? You've got 165 years. So what you have to do, if it's going to be Darius II, is say, well, he's got to be 165 years plus old enough, or these people have to be 165 years plus old enough to see Solomon's temple and remember what it looks like. So they've got to be over 165 years old. And again, people just didn't live that long at that time. Now, they were back at the time that Job lived. Fine, Job lived around 200 years of age. But the longevity of life had cut down tremendously. Started to cut down in Moses' time. Moses, you remember, lived 120 years. And then he wrote Psalm 90 where he said the normal span of man's life is 3 score years and 10. But for those two reasons, Darius II, Nopus would be ruled out. And then, of course, Haggai is talking here about the building of the temple. And Lenka mentioned something very interesting, that the temple was completed in the sixth year of Darius. Remember that? Tuesday. Now, that was 515 B.C. And since the temple was built and completed in his reign, then that would rule out Darius II. The temple wasn't built and completed in the reign of Darius II. It was completed, built and completed in the reign of Darius I. So Darius I would definitely be the king in view here. And it would be in his reign. He started to reign 521 B.C. Darius I, known as Hystaspes, and the second year of his reign would be 520 B.C. So we can fix that year. We know that's the year we're talking about toward the end of the 6th century B.C. Now the month, you'll notice the month is given in the second year of Darius the king, in the 6th month. Now that would be the month Elul, and that is part of August, part of September in our calendar year. So we know the month, but then we're also given the day. It's amazing how explicit the time factor is in these messages. The second year of Darius the king, in the 6th month, that would be part of August and September, in the first day of the month, in the first day of the month, Elul. Now, this is very fascinating because this was the day of the feast of a new moon. And why is that so significant? Well, what happened on the day of the feast of the new moon, the first day of the month? Well, they offered a special sacrifice to the Lord, but also there was a religious meeting to be held on the Feast of the New Moon at the temple. Now, here is the first day of the month, the Feast of the New Moon. They are to have a religious gathering at the temple, but there's no temple there. What more appropriate time to deliver a message? The people would be very, very susceptible to Haggai's message about the rebuilding of the temple at this time, because here they are, the Feast of the New Moon. They offer their sacrifice to the Lord like they're supposed to. Then they're supposed to gather at the temple, but the temple is not there. And on this day, especially, they would be very painfully and doubly conscious that that temple wasn't there, because they were supposed to meet right there. You see the way the Lord picks his time? See, he just picks the right time to deliver the message. So he picked the time when the Jews would have a religious gathering right there at the temple. There'd be no temple there. So they would say, well, we're supposed to gather according to the law. See, we offer our sacrifice according to the law. We're supposed to gather, but there's no temple there. They were very conscious that there was no temple there, thus very susceptible to the message that the temple needed to be rebuilt. And that's why the Lord had it delivered at that particular time. He picks a time when they would be made very, very conscious of the absence of that temple. And then they picked that time to drive this message home to them. Now, it's very interesting that when this message is given, that this message is exactly the message that the people needed at this time. The Lord wanted that temple built. They weren't doing it. Here is a task the Lord wanted done. They weren't doing it. And we're going to see why. They weren't doing it. But the fact is, they weren't doing it. And what the Lord did was to give them, at this very appropriate time, just the message that they needed. The Lord knew what they needed. They needed to be told to get with it, get with this work. And the message was suitable to the need that was prevalent at that particular time. It met the basic need those people had of getting that temple up. And what Haggai is doing is preaching a sermon right to the needs of the people. That's a good way to preach. I think that's a good way to preach. And to pick an appropriate time to do it. See, you know what the needs are. You see how the Lord arranges this? He knows what the need is. Temple needs to be built. There's a task that needs to be done. So he directs the message right to that need, and he picks the best possible time to give it. A time when they will be very susceptible to that message, because they would be very conscious that the temple before which they were to gather was not there, particularly at the Feast of the New Moon. And there's nothing like preaching need. And you fellows who preach, ladies who teach, teaching your ladies' Bible class, or fellows are preaching, preach and teach the needs. Make sure it's relevant to the people. That is so important. Now, let's look at the recipients of the message. Now, the message is given to Zerubbabel. Notice it says in the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, by the hand of Haggai the prophet, unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah. Now, Zerubbabel was one of the recipients of the message. Now, what was his other name, remember?
Sheshbazzar.
And he's called that a number of times in the book of Ezra. We saw that is his one name. Yeah, Babylonian or Chaldean. Babylonian, Chaldean, say. So his Babylonian or Chaldean name. Now, first let's look at his lineage, his ancestry. Very interesting. First, his father. Shealtiel. There is the son of Shealtiel. Now, we need to notice this about Shealtiel. This word is written two ways. Now, if you look at these notes, that Hebrew, to those of you who haven't had Hebrew, may look like chicken scratching. But look at that word. Now, you see the word I have in parentheses. Now, I just want you to notice this. You don't even have to know Hebrew to notice this. It's written this way in this verse right here, chapter 1, verse 1. And also in Haggai 2:23, 1 Chronicles 3:17, Ezra 3:2, Nehemiah 12:1. But in chapter 1, verses 12, 14, and 2:2, it is contracted into Shealtiel. Now I want you to notice. Now look at those two forms. You see the second letter of the first form? Do you see it there in the second form? No, see, it's missing. And notice those two dots under the first letter. See those two dots? Now, they're also missing in the second form. See, the second form is contracted. So you can understand that. There's a letter missing, and there's two little dots that represent a vowel sound, a half vowel, that are missing. So here you have a letter missing, and you have a half vowel missing in the contracted form. But that word is written two ways, but it's the same name, Shealtiel or Shealtiel. Now, it distinctly says that Zerubbabel is the son of Shealtiel. But turn to 1 Chronicles 3:19. And somebody read that to me. 1 Chronicles 3:19. Who has it?
Son of Abraham, tremendous number
associated. Now, in 1 Chronicles, now it depends on the Bible that you have here. I want to point this out to you. Let's turn now to 1 Chronicles 3:17. 1 Chronicles 3:17. And now, I'm going to read out of the King James Version I have here. Now, in some of the later King James Versions, it's going to be a little different. In the NIV, it will be different, but I'll explain the difference. Now, listen to me. 1 Chronicles 3:17. And the sons of Jeconiah. And then it says, Asir. Now, Asir, according to this translation, would be one of the sons of Jeconiah. Now, Jeconiah would be the same as Kaniah, or what other name is given to him? Anybody remember? Jehoiachin. Remember one of the kings of Judah? Son of Jehoiakim. So you had Jehoiakim, and you had Jehoiachin. This is Jehoiachin, the son of Jehoiakim. Everybody with me? No sleepy scribes? All right, now, short scribe essays. Now, answer right there would be the son of Jehoiachin. And he would be listed as one of his two sons. Look at verse 16. Jeconiah, his son, that is the son of Jehoiakim. Zedekiah, his son, that is the son of Jeconiah or Jehoiachin, and the sons of Jeconiah and Jehoiachin also at Seir. So, Zedekiah in verse 16 and at Seir, according to some, would be the two sons of Jehoiachin. Now, in some versions, they take that word at Seir as a descriptive word meaning captive. And they would translate it as the son of Jehoiachin, the captain. They don't take it to refer to a person. They take it to be a descriptive word meaning captain. And the word does mean captain. No question about that. The NIV takes it that way. I have a New Schofield Bible home. I look at that. That takes it that way. Anybody have an NASB? It has that as well. Now, it can be taken that way. There's no question about that. Or it can be Asir, a proper name. And the interesting thing is that you have to decide which way you're going to go here with it. So it is either Asir, who would be the grandfather of Zerubbabel. You would have Zerubbabel, then you would have Shealtiel, who would be the father of Zerubbabel, and then you would have his grandfather, who would be Asir. Now, I want to be careful when I say grandfather, because technically, Asir, and mark this down, and I should clarify this in the notes, is it wouldn't be his grandfather, according to this view, but his great-grandfather. Now, I'll show you why in just a moment. His grandfather, through Shealtiel, actually his great-grandfather, would be a seer. Then, if you turn to Luke 3:27, you'll find that Neri is stated as the father of Shealtiel. Somebody read me Luke chapter 3 and verse 27. Who has it? Okay. Gloria, do you have it?
Yes.
Okay.
The son of Joanan, the son of Reza, the son of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the son of Neri.
All right. Now, there, see, Shealtiel comes from Neri. See? Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 17. He comes from a seer, if that is a proper name, who would be his great-grandfather, but Neri wouldn't be in that line at all. See? He would have nothing to do with that particular line of descent. He's in a different line of descent. And you would go Zerubbabel, Shealtiel, and as far as the next male is concerned, it would be Asir, if that is a proper name, or if that is a descriptive name, then you would have Jehoiachin. So either you're going to go Zerubbabel, his father Shealtiel, then his great-grandfather Asir, and his great-great-grandfather Jehoiachin. You're either going to go that route, or if Asir is not a proper name, but is a descriptive word meaning captive, like you have, then it would be Zerubbabel, his father Shealtiel, and then it would be his great-grandfather Jehoiachin. You see it? The male line would go that way. Now, the question is, how do we put all of this together? Now, is everybody wide awake? No sleepy scribes, no sleepy scribes. All right, now, let me try to explain how this is going to work. Now, Jeremiah made a prophecy, a prediction concerning Jehoiachin. Somebody turn to Jeremiah 22, verse 30, and somebody read that prediction. So, Jeremiah 22, verse 30.
This is what the Lord says: record this man as a childless man who will not prosper in his lifetime, and none of his offspring will prosper, none will sit on the throne of David or rule anymore.
Alright. None of his offspring. Now, what that means is people that come directly from him, from his seed. No one from Jehoiachin, or Jeconiah, or Kadiah, he has all three of those names. No one who descends from his seed is going to sit on the throne of David and rule in Judah. The Lord said, now when he says right and childless, he didn't mean that he's not going to have any children. But what he means is no one from Jehoiachin is going to sit on the throne of David and rule in Judah. Now, that prediction is going to be fulfilled. And here is the way it is going to be fulfilled. Now, before I show you how it's going to be fulfilled, Jehoiachin, remember, is in the ancestral line of Jesus through whom? Joseph. And it's through Joseph that Jesus has what? The legal right to the throne. The inheritance comes down. His legal right to reign comes through Joseph. And Jehoiachin is in that line. And yet no seed from Jehoiachin is going to sit on the throne of David and rule. And yet Jesus is in that line, and he's going to sit on the throne of David and rule. Now, how did that work out? Well, here's what happens. Jehoiachin, according to some, that is Jeconiah, his son, Zedekiah. Now, everybody see that Zedekiah right there? Now, that Zedekiah is not the last king of Judah. The last king of Judah is mentioned in the preceding verse. The last king of Judah, whose name was also Zedekiah, was the brother of Jehoiakim. Now, what was the relationship of Jehoiakim to Jehoiachin help? What was the relationship of the two? Jehoiakim was what? Father of Jehoiachin. Now, Zedekiah is the brother of Jehoiakim. That makes him what relationship to Jehoiachin? Uncle. Everybody with me? Alright. Now, the Zedekiah, who was the brother of Jehoiakim, the uncle of Jehoiachin, is the one that's mentioned in verse 15. And in the Hebrew, it has a little different spelling. It's got a little vowel on the end there. A little different spelling than the one that is mentioned in verse 16. You'll notice I put this note whose name was spelled, then I wrote it down here. You can see in 1 Chronicles 3:15. Now you see that last mark there? It looks like this. See this mark for those of you who don't know Hebrew? See that? See that right there? Now see, that is not on the name Zedekiah in verse 16. It is a little different spelling. So that particular vowel, that's a vowel, and that is not on the name in verse 16. But Zedekiah in verse 16 was one of the sons, according to this view, of Jehoiachin. Now, according to this view in verse 17, Asir would be a second son. It wouldn't mean captain, like you have in some of your Bibles. But it would be a proper name. And it would be Asir, and he would be also the son of Jehoiachin. So he would have two sons, Zedekiah in verse 16, and Asir, A-S-S-I-R, in verse 17. Everybody with me?
I don't see a seer in verse 17.
No, it's got, you probably have captive there.
Yes.
See, the word captive is the word a seer. And see, what this view would say is that it's not a descriptive word, meaning captive. It's not describing Jehoiachin, the captive, but rather its proper name referring to his son, a seer. With me? Okay. Now, Jehoiachin has how many sons then? Tell me. I've got to keep you with me on this. Two. The name of the one is? Zedekiah. And what verse is he found?
16.
Verse 16. And the second one is? Asir. Translated in some of your Bibles as what? Captive. But according to some, that would be a proper name, referring to the second son of Jehoiachin. Now, the first son, Zedekiah, had no children whatsoever. The second son, Asir, A-S-S-I-R, if he is a second son, had a daughter with him. No son. So neither one of those two boys had any sons. Zedekiah had no children at all, so obviously he didn't have a son. And Asir didn't have a son, but had a daughter. Alright? Everybody follow so far? So, Jehoiachin, there it is. Two sons, Zedekiah and Asir. The only child that they have is had by whom? Asir. And what was that child, girl or boy? Girl. Now, the daughter of Asir marries Neri. Now, there are two things you have to keep in mind regarding the daughter of Asir. Number one, since she was the only child, though she was a girl, she gets the inheritance. So the inheritance is going to go through her, the legal right to the throne. Now turn to Numbers, chapter 27, verse 8. Somebody read that to me. Numbers 27, verse 8. Numbers chapter 27, verse 8. Whoever gets it. Got it there, Eric? Go ahead, Pete.
Further, you shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter.
There it is. All right. So, here is Asir, has no son. He only has a daughter. What happens to his inheritance according to that verse? The daughter. All right, so she's got the inheritance. Now, what about her marriage? Can she marry anybody she wants? Can she? Somebody tell her. See, now here's a seer. Got a lovely daughter. Married, marriageable age. Now can she just say, well, I'll just fall in love with somebody and marry him? Is that the way it's going to work? Was there any restriction on the one she could marry? Anybody? Don? That's right. She has to marry within the tribe of her father. So she was in the tribe of what? Judah. Now, if she wanted to marry somebody in the tribe of Dan, could she do that? No. Why? Because the inheritance would never be transferred to another tribe. See, that's what would happen. And so, she had to marry within her own tribe. And this is brought out in Numbers 36, verses 8 and 9. If somebody get that verse and read it to me. Numbers 36, 8 and 9. Got it, Gloria? Yes. Go ahead.
And every daughter who comes into possession of an inheritance of any tribe of the sons of Israel shall be wife to one of the family of the tribe of her father, so that the sons of Israel each may possess the inheritance of his fathers.
That's right. Stop right there. You see it? That spells it out just as plainly as you want. here she's going to marry. So nearing had to be of what tribe? Of Judah. But guess to which family he belonged? Anybody guess? He belonged to the family of David. The same family to which the daughter of Jehoiachin, of Esther, belonged. And the way we know that is in Luke 3:27. You have that ancestral line going all the way back through David, but not through Solomon, but through Solomon's brother Nathan. And of course, who was it that descended from that line that's given in Luke 3? Can you tell me? Who was it that, why is that whole genealogy given there? That whole list of ancestors. Well,
Joseph.
No, not Joseph. Mary. See, that is tracing back the human nature of Jesus. See, and Mary comes from that line, not Joseph. See, Luke gives Mary's genealogy, and it traces it all the way back to David through Nathan, not through Solomon. The legal right goes through Solomon. That's the genealogy you have in Matthew. The genealogy in Luke 3 is the genealogy of Mary, and it takes it right on back. So here is Neri now. Now, he's of the family of David, but not through Solomon. Not through the one who had the inheritance. Not through the one through whom the legal right to the throne came, but rather through Nathan. Now, what the daughter of Esther does, she doesn't have any brothers, so she gets the inheritance. Right, Eric? She gets married, but but she has to marry somebody within her own tribe. And so she does. She marries Neri, and Neri is not only within her own tribe, but of the family of David. And so the two get married. Now, after the two get married, now remember you got Jehoiachin, and you got Esther, and you got his daughter. So Jehoiachin is the daughter's grandfather. You see it? Her father would be Esther, her grandfather Jehoiachin. Everybody still away? Now then, once they get married, they have children. And their children are given to us. Now, read 1 Chronicles 3, 17 and 18. You'll find seven names there. Seven children that they have. Somebody get that and read it, please. Alright, now you can stop right there. Now, what I want you to do, I want you to focus on Shealtiel. Does that name sound familiar? Alright, now Shealtiel was the son of the daughter of Esther and Neri. You see it? Now, I want you to watch this. The seed comes from Neri, not from Jehoiachin. See it? Remember he said no one from Jehoiachin's seed would sit on the throne of David and rule? We say Jehoiachin had a seer. He was a boy. But a seer didn't have a boy. He only had a daughter. And he married Neri. So the seed comes from Neri. But Neri goes back to David because the Messiah was to be of the seed of Ruth. And this is the way this is going to work out. You're beginning to see it. Shealtiel was the oldest son. You count those names up. Well, you don't have to read them all. Later you see seven names there all together. Alright. Now, I want you to underscore the first one. Shealtiel. He is the oldest. Now, there's another son there, Padiah, the second brother. You see that? Now watch him. Have you heard that name before? Ed? Padiah? Yeah, yeah. See, he's going to be one of the fathers of Zerubbabel. All right, now everybody with me so far? All right, now we've got the daughter of Esther, and we got Neri getting married. Now they're going to have a happy family. Seven kids. Okay, there they are. And Shealtiel is the oldest. Now, Shealtiel, being the oldest, gets the inheritance of his grandfather, Esther. And because he gets the inheritance of his grandfather, Esther, he is put in the register as his son because he got the inheritance. Now he's put in the register as his son, but Esther is really his maternal grandfather, his grandfather on his mother's side. But he's registered as his son because he got the inheritance. He's the heir. And so you have Shealtiel, who is actually the grandson of Esther, being listed as his son because he got the inheritance. Now, we have Shealtiel. Now, Shealtiel gets married. Logical thing to do. They want children. But guess what? No children. They don't get it. And then, Shealtiel dies. And there is his wife left with no children. What happens in a situation like that?
Mary married the brother of Shealtiel.
but just read me verses 5 and 6. Somebody get those verses. Deuteronomy 25, I think 5 and 6 will give it that to us. Whoever gets it, just read it right out. Kevin, Eric?
When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of his deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife to perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, and her name may not be blotted out.
There you are. You see what happens? Now, which brother married Shealtiel's widow? Adiah, the second brother. Now notice in that list, remember that list you had there, Lincoln? See, he wasn't the first brother, he was the second brother. And he married the widow. And they had several children. The first one who was born was who? Zerubbabel. So Zerubbabel, since he was the first one who was born, is put in the register as whose son? Shealtiel. So that the inheritance, see, he's put in the register, Shealtiel, Zerubbabel. Was he biologically Shealtiel's son? No. He was Padiah's son. But he's put in the register as the son and heir of Shealtiel, so that Shealtiel's name can be carried on and the inheritance passed on. And so when it says Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, Shealtiel biologically was his what? Uncle. But in the register, he is placed there as his son because of what you read in Deuteronomy 25. Adiah was his real father, gave birth to him. But he's put in the register as the son and heir of Shealtiel, though he really wasn't Shealtiel's son. So that Shealtiel could have his name carried on and his inheritance passed on. Now, see, this is the way it works up. So now, let me just go through it again. Jehoiachin had how many children? Two. Name of one, Zedekiah. Name of the other, Asir. Did Zedekiah have any kids? No. Did Asir have a daughter? All right. So that makes Jehoiachin her what? Grandfather. You with me? Now, the daughter of Esther gets married. Who is it that she married? Neri. And Neri was in the tribe of Judah and belonged to what family? Family of David. They get married and they have seven children. Perfect number. Quiver is full. Happy as a man whose quiver is full. So, seven children. Who was the first one who was born? Shealtiel. So Shealtiel gets the inheritance of his maternal grandfather and thus is listed as his son and heir in the register. Though he's really his grandson, he's listed as his son. See? And then Shealtiel gets married, but do they have any children? No children. He dies. What happens to his wife? Marries his second brother. The first one who was born was who? Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel is placed in the family register as whose son and heir? Shealtiel, even though Shealtiel was really his what? Uncle. Are you all with me? that Jehoiachin would be Zerubbabel's great, great grandfather. You see it? Now then, do you see how the prediction that Jeremiah gave, that no one from the seed of Jehoiachin would sit on the throne of David and rule in Judah? You see how that was fulfilled? Because once Asir's daughter married Neri, it was Neri's seed that followed through, not Jehoiachin's seed. And so, no one from Jehoiachin, just like the Lord said, would ever, ever sit on the throne of David and rule in Judah. Jesus, say, would have his legal right from the line of Jehoiachin, but he wouldn't be of the seed of Jehoiachin. Say, his human nature would have come from Mary, the Holy Spirit being his father. The Holy Spirit calls Mary to beget Jesus without human instrumentality. But the human line of Mary goes right back to David, so that Jesus, as far as his human nature is concerned, is a descendant of things would fit together in this genealogy. So when you read here that Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, he was legally the son of Shealtiel. Shealtiel was really his uncle, but he was legally the son of Shealtiel. And of course, Jehoiachin would have been his great grandfather. Now, there's only one problem with this view. A lot of it explains a lot of things. But there's one little problem with it. Anybody know what it is? That's one thing. All right. Now, if a seer is not a proper name, then what you would do is just eliminate that. And what you would say is that instead of a seer, the son of Jehoiachin having a daughter, and she marrying Neri, it would be the daughter of Jehoiachin who would marry him. So you would eliminate a generation. Everybody with me on that? So you would have Jehoiachin. Then he would have a daughter, and she would get the inheritance. Not sure what they would do with Zedekiah. I guess they would say he wasn't his son at all. Had a daughter, she would get the inheritance. She would marry Neri, and then right on that. So you would eliminate one of the generations. But there was another matter of which I was thinking. That's one thing here, that a seer can be a descriptive word. Now, if it is, you just eliminate one of the generations there, and you would say Jehoiachin had a daughter. Because that much would be there's either a daughter or a granddaughter, one or the other. All right, but there's another problem. Anybody know what it is? When was Jehoiachin taken into captivity? What year? 597 BC. Now then, what year did Zerubbabel lead with others, the children of Israel, almost 50,000, back to the province of Judah? What year? getting rid of a seer. That's probably one of the reasons why it's captive in some of those Bibles, so that instead of a seer being a son of Jehoiachin, it just means Jehoiachin the captive, describing him as the captive, one who was taken into Babylon. And that would leave four generations that have to, which you have to get into. The other way that Hendrickson suggests all this is to say that the daughter of Jehoiachin possibly married not Neri, but Neri's son, Shealtiel. And they get it in that way. But it's easier with the or that explanation. Now, do you understand the last part that I gave? The daughter of Jehoiachin marrying Shealtiel himself, who would be the son of Neri. So instead of marrying Neri, marrying his son Shealtiel. That way you could get it in. But see that the time frame, 61 years is all you have. Because you know when Jehoiachin was taken into captivity. And you know when Zerubbabel led the Jews together with others in leadership back to Jerusalem by 536 BC. So those 2 days are fixed. And you have 61 years to work in. 5 generations as seer is Jehoiachin's son. Or 4 generations, if it means captive, and thus it would be the daughter of Jehoiachin. And maybe you can shorten it a little more if you say that the daughter of Jehoiachin, instead of marrying Neri, married Neri's son, Shealtiel. That is the daughter of Jehoiachin who did that. But we can't be sure of that. But that takes care of the genealogy there. Didn't realize all that would be in that genealogy, did you? But any questions on that? Follow it through, okay?
So it's better to remove a seer generation?
Well, I don't know if it's...
Because there's only 61 years.
Yeah. It would probably fit better with the 61 years, but I'm not ready to say it has to be removed. Because you don't have to live out the full generation. People can marry pretty young. And, you know, in earlier days, people get married 12, 13, 14 years old. So, but still, you got to push it. Now, of course, see, Jehoiachin, he wasn't too old, but, you know, he could have had a seer. He could have been getting along there a little bit when he was taken into captivity. So I'm not ready to rule the other out, but the time frame may make it a little easier on you if you said instead of a seer being the son, that it would be a descriptive word meaning captive. That's what the NIV, the NAS. His position. Now, he was the Persian governor of Judah, the temporal or civil head of the nation of Israel, who appointed Zerubbabel to this position of being the governor of the province of Judah. Who appointed him? Remember? Cyrus. Remember in Ezra chapter 6, it specifies very clearly that Cyrus had appointed him to that position. Then the second person to whom this message was given was Joshua. His lineage, his father, was Jehozadak. Now, if you look at 1 Chronicles 6:15, you'll find that Jehozadak was one who was carried away by the Chaldeans to Babylon as a captive. Somebody just read me that verse very quickly. 1 Chronicles 6:13. It mentions Jehozadak, and it says that he was carried away as a captive to Babylon. Who has that verse? Very quick. Okay, Gloria?
And Jehoshadak went along when the Lord carried Judah and Jerusalem away into exile by Nebuchadnezzar.
All right. So when Nebuchadnezzar carried away, Jehoshadak was taken into captivity. And then his grandfather was the high priest Sariah, whom Nebuchadnezzar had caused to be executed at Riblah in the year 588 B.C. after he had conquered Jerusalem. Now, on this occasion, what Nebuchadnezzar did was to gather Sariah, who was the high priest, and some others, and he had these people brought at Riblah, where he was, and he had them all executed. But Sariah, the high priest, who was executed by Nebuchadnezzar after he had conquered Jerusalem, was the grandfather of Joshua, son of Jehozadak, and the one who was the high priest in Israel when they returned to their own land. So there you have his genealogy, and you can read about that in those references that I've given. We won't take time to read that now. Then his position, he was the high priest, he was the spiritual head of the nation. So here is Zerubbabel. He was appointed by Cyrus to be the temporal or civil leader. Here is Joshua. He was the spiritual leader, the high priest. Now, you must be careful to distinguish between Joshua, the son of Nun, the one who succeeded Moses. He lived around 1400 B.C. And Joshua, the son of Jehozadak. Now, you see, Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, lived in 520 B.C. Joshua, the son of Nun, who succeeded Moses, 1400 B.C. So Joshua, the son of Nun, who succeeded Moses, is almost 900 years before the Joshua of whom we are speaking here. Now let's look at the source of the message. The message that Haggai delivered to Zerubbabel and Joshua came from the Lord. Now it's interesting. You look through these verses. Just notice verse 1. Came the word of the Lord by, now remember what the Hebrew says there, by the hand of Haggai, the prophet, unto Zerubbabel. Look at verse 2. Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, look at verse 3. Then came the word of the Lord by the hand of Haggai. See, Haggai is just the instrument. He is the one who is delivering the word of the Lord to the people, by the hand of Haggai, the human instrument just taking the word of the Lord and passing it on. Look at verse 5. It says, thus saith the Lord of hosts. Look at verse 7. Thus saith the Lord of hosts. Look at verse 8. Saith the Lord. Look at verse 9. Saith the Lord of hosts. Look at verse 12. Verse 12 says, they obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the words of Haggai the prophet as the Lord their God had sent him. They realized that he was from the Lord. Look at verse 13. Then spake Haggai, the Lord's messenger, in the Lord's message. He was the messenger who had the Lord's message to give. And you see what Haggai is doing is driving home the people. Now look, this is not what I'm saying. I'm just a human instrument. I'm just taking the message from headquarters and passing it on. What I'm telling you comes straight from the Lord. So if you have any arguments, not with me, with the Lord, see, because all I'm doing is passing on the word of the Lord. The Lord's messenger in the Lord's message. He took the message that God gave him and he just passed it on. Do we learn any lesson there? See, aren't we to be the human instruments that the Lord used to pass on his message? Now, when we pass on that message and we get up and give our opinion, what everybody else thinks, well, we to pass on the word of the Lord. Now, that's what we are to do. We can learn a real lesson there. And we need to make sure that we take that message not off. touching, not water it down, but take that message just as it is and pass it on. That we become the human instrument by which that message is passed on. And this is what Haggai did. He took that message and he passed it on just as it was. And over again, he kept reminding people, folks, this is not what I'm saying to you. Thus saith the Lord, thus saith the Lord. Thus the Lord speaketh. This is his message. And we need to drive it home that it's not our message. See? It's what God says. It's not what we think about what God says, but it's what God says. And the source of the message, it came directly from the Lord. Now, let's get to the content of the message. The content of the message. Now, Haggai was made up a good Southern Baptist. He had 3 points. And you can see these 3 points very, very clearly in his message. Now, not all of his messages will have 3 points. But on this one, it has 3 points. And we want to see them. Now, here is the first point. The Lord rebuked his people for their indifference toward the work he wanted them to do, namely, the rebuilding of the temple. Now, we're going to see this in verses 2 through 4. Now, this is where he starts out. He rebukes the Lord's people for their indifference towards the work he wanted them to do. Now, if the Lord's people were indifferent towards the work he wanted them to do, there should be some evidence of it. Is that right? Is there any evidence that is suggested here in this text about the fact that the Lord's people to whom Haggai is giving this message were indifferent towards the work the Lord wanted them to do? Larry?
Priorities. They were preoccupied with their own building of their own personal homes and this sort of thing, delighting with the work of the Lord.
Alright. Alright. Now, that is one thing very explicitly. And we want to work on that. The pursuit of their own personal interests at the expense of doing the work the Lord wanted them to do, namely to build the temple, at the expense of it. Now we're going to look at that. Anything else?
But they it's not time to build the temple.
Yeah, it's not time to build the temple. Who was that? Why did they say it wasn't time to build the temple? Huh? Wake up? Yeah. Well, that's why they were saying it. But what were they doing? Oh, you got it. You got it. Excuses. See? Now, you touched on the two things that very definitely show their indifference. Now let's look at it. First of all, the excuse they gave for not doing the work of the Lord wanted them to do. Now, what was that excuse? Now this is going to show their indifference, their I don't care attitude. Notice verse 2. Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say, this people. This people say, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Now there was that foundation sitting there for 15 years. Not a lick of work done. And somebody say, how come you don't work at all? Well, it's not time to build the house. The time hasn't come to build the house. Well, that's why we're not. Well, why did they say the time hadn't come? Why did they say that? Michael? Yeah. Well, can't you see them? Look at the circumstances. You mentioned that, didn't you? Look at the circumstances. What? We're in drought. And because failed. Now, surely, with our crops failing year after year, you expect us to go out and build a temple for the Lord? Why, we can scarcely get along ourselves. And with this drought and our crops failing, in these circumstances, you want us to build the temple? How do you expect us to do it? After all, times aren't so good right now. Now, times are good, good crops, you want to build the temple. But they're not good right now. And then they said, now, look at the oppression under which we're suffering. Well, what was that oppression? Who was bothering? Samaritans. Look what those Samaritans are doing. You know what they've done? They can't get this picture of somebody who looks at it. Why don't you work? Let me tell you about these Samaritans. They don't understand. You know what those Samaritans did? See, they hired those counselors over there in the king's court, and they're bad mouthing us, trying to get us in bed with the king of Persia all the time. And they're doing that right along. And then they wrote this letter to the Cambyses, and they made an accusation against us. And then they really got through to Pseudo-Smyrnus, and he issued this edict saying, we can't build. So how do you expect us to build? It's not time. The oppression we're under, the circumstances, not time to build. And the Lord says they're nothing but what? Flimsy excuses. He wanted them to build. And what they were doing was making excuses. And the excuses revealed their indifference. See, if they really wanted to build that temple, they would have built it. But they didn't want to build it. And that's why it wasn't being built. And the Lord said, this people say, see, just get the tone there. This people say, it's not time to build a house. Lord. Every time somebody asks about it, it's not time to build it. And so this just shows their indifference. Now, can we learn any lessons from that about doing the work of the Lord? You've never heard anybody make an excuse today about not being able to do the work of the Lord, have you? You know, I don't have time. You never heard that before, did you? I don't have time to do the work of the Lord. But isn't it amazing that when we really want to do something, we find the time when we really want to do it? But we don't want to do it. Well, I don't have time. If you get something you really want to do, you'll make time. And somebody else says, well, I don't have the talent to do it. Short on talent. When you talk to some people, say, no matter what you have to do before, they're short on talent. Holy Spirit's given every believer at least one spiritual gift. So, you see, that person's got power to do something. And that's just a flimsy excuse. Or sometimes, you know, they may say, God just hired me. Just hired me. Just can't do it. Let me tell you something. If you get something that they really want to do, they will be able to use you the name. I remember the other day, my wife was just dog tired. And she says, you know, there's only one thing that could ever get me to do it. I said, what's that? She said, if one of our girls called her, go out. Boy, I tell you, she'd be rejuvenated. And they did call her. She'd be rejuvenated just like that. Otherwise, she would have been out of it and said, just an exhibit. You know, people find excuses for not doing the work of the Lord. And what those excuses do is reveal their indifference. See? And they show they really don't care about doing it. Now, here you have one of the evidences of their indifference, the excuse that they make for not. pursuit of their own personal interest at the expense of the work the Lord wanted them to do. Now look at verse 4. Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your steel houses, your wainscoted houses? You know what these people were doing? Building beautiful wainscoted houses. You say, what in the world is that? Well, it's building a house with the inside walls inside the house, all covered over, inlaid with costly woodwork. See? Now, isn't it amazing that they could build themselves houses like that? And here they were, building themselves these beautiful houses with the rooms inside, all covered over with this costly woodwork. And at the same time, neglecting the house of the Lord. They didn't have time to do anything for that. But they had time to build themselves beautiful houses. See, what were they doing? They were putting their personal interests ahead of the work of the Lord. So they were taking care of that at the expense of the work of the Lord. They weren't. It's not as though they were doing this and doing the work of the Lord. They weren't doing anything all that time. But they were taking care of their own personal interests. Now, does that show any difference? If we just take care of our own personal interests, we just let the work of the Lord go. Do you think anybody does that today? No. Do they? You think some people get so wrapped up in their jobs that little by little they just cut themselves off from the work of the Lord, see their personal interests, their job? That's more important to them than the work of the Lord. So they cut themselves off from the first thing. No! They're not going to call them. But first, you can't be on the board anymore. You can't go to this meeting. You can't go to that meeting. Jobs taking more and more time. See, the job is doing that because you're busy. How about some people with their home bringing closer to this? Are they all spend all their time with them. Oh, nothing wrong with doing that if you're doing the work of the Lord. But when you do it at the expense of the work of the Lord, so you have all this time to be able to do the home and no time to do the work of the Lord, then what does that show for the work of the Lord? Does that show any difference? Well, you know, some people, they kind of have their wrong. Now, nothing wrong with golf if you're doing the work of the Lord. See? But if you do it at the expense, I can't do the work of the Lord. I can't do my presentation very long. I can't do the church Sunday night. I've got a golf engagement. Can't go Sunday morning. You know, I've got to, you know, there are multiple. Personal interest, say, putting it above the work of the Lord. Now, see, those things reveal their indifference. And when they built themselves these homes, now, these homes, these wainscoted homes, they were homes in which the rich and distinguished lived. And when a person was living in a home like that, that was a sign that he was living a life of luxury. There they were. They were able to do that. But they weren't able to do the work of the Lord. So the evidence of their indifference is there. And the Lord is going to rebuke them for it. We've got to stop there. But the Lord is going to rebuke them for it. And you watch that rebuke. The Lord knows just how to get to them. He knows just how to touch the right curve. And he's going to do it. All right.